So we're going to continue on this theme of unlearning, which to me, it's like, I just want to continue on this theme. There's so much for me to learn. I don't know how you all feel. We'll see how you feel at the end of the class. But this is part three of unlearning. And I would like to just read a few statements from the last month or so. Well, last month we deviated because we did our camp. But I think it's good to just slightly review. And Mirsha Hazaran Naikon is who I'm referring to here. He says, it is most difficult to forget what one has once learned. Learning is one thing and unlearning is another. The process of spiritual attainment is through unlearning. So we know that we form these constructs in the mind, which can give impressions to the heart and the soul. And once we have these impressions, we don't always willingly give them up. And we've talked about that from a scientific point of view, that our understanding of the universe, of ourselves, is only as effective as the tools that we use to measure it. And so too, our understanding of the world is only as effective as the broadening of the outlook. So Murchard goes to say, mental purification, therefore, is the only method by which one can reach the spiritual goal. Mental purification. So it's good for us if we can try to, you know, catch ourselves. Like, am I going over the same territory again and again? And if so, why? What am I getting from that? Is there a way I can re-script that? Is there a way that I can relieve myself of that habitual sort of thinking? I think that's what's being suggested here. Now, Murshid gives 5 points. We talked about the first two during our last classes. One was to take another's point of view. So Murshid says here, the larger our view, you start with just two people, one self and another person. Okay, I see this from my point of view, but what could their point of view be? And Murshid says, by doing that, our view gets bigger and our consciousness expands. And he says, if you can do it with another person, why not do it with 1,000 people? And one begins to see in a much broader context. I mean, how do we know our point of view is correct? We may feel it very strongly. We may be very attached to it. But there are many points of view, and it may be wise to entertain that as well. We worked with a practice, a sacred name called Wasiya, which means to release from old boundaries. It is an antidote for rigid, habitual boundaries. So if we feel like we're trapped or in a box somehow, you know, this is a good practice. Pir Vilayat would talk about the expansion of the etheric field into infinite space, but always being able to return back home, not getting so spaced out that one couldn't function. But, you know, having this sort of membrane around us, but we can expand and we can contract as needed. Now, I thought I was doing some more, I was looking at this because let me move on. I'm going on to point number two. So hold on, remember that practice, Wasiya. Expansion, boundless, perhaps all-embracing, all-encompassing. And the Mirsha talks about look for the right in the wrong and the wrong in the right. How important is this to do? Murshid says the next step in mental purification is to be able to see the right of the wrong and the wrong of the right, the evil of the good and the good of the evil. It's a difficult task, but once one has accomplished this, one rises above good and evil. So this is a very interesting point as well. I keep referring to those lines of the prayers come to me, raise us above the denseness of the earth, lift us above the denseness of the earth. raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide us. These are profound things to contemplate. But I also went into one of the Sufi message volumes called The Alchemy of Happiness, because Murshid talks about this many, many times. It's not just once we see this subject arise. And he says it very bluntly, and I think it's good for us to hear this. He says, a stupid or simple person is always ready to see the wrong in another and ready to form an opinion and to judge. But you will find a wise person expressing his opinion of others quite differently. Always trying to tolerate, always trying to forgive still more. The present is the reflection of the past, and the future will be an echo of the present. This saying will always prove true. Does anyone want to hear that line again? I think it's very, very important. So Murshid says, the present is the reflection of the past, and the future will be the echo of the present. This saying will always prove true. Now, Lord Buddha said it in this way, because, you know, so many people want to know, what was my past life? What's my future and fate going to be? So on and so forth. And Lord Buddha says it this way. If you want to know about your past lives, look at your present condition. If you want to know about your past lives, look at your present condition. If you want to know about your future lives, look at your present actions. Would you like to hear that again? Yeah. So it makes us aware of our responsibility. So Lord Buddha says, if you want to know about your past lives, look at your present condition. If you want to know about your future lives, look at your present actions. So being mindful, we hear that term a lot in meditation. But I don't know. I mean, it's a challenge to be mindful every moment of our life. But it's a good thing, because we will receive the echoes of the present. We worked with a practice called Yahalim, H-A-L-I-M, which is calm abiding. It's forbearance, it's forgiveness, it's acceptance. But here again, one has to be mindful. Most of you know I've spent a great deal of time at monasteries in India and close to some profound teachers, and have been able to ask questions and hear other people ask their questions. And one of the things that comes up a lot is compassion, this idea of compassion. And it's often said by the various teachers there, well, there's one, compassion is one thing, idiot compassion is another. And sometimes we think compassion is being accepting and tolerant. Yes, it is. But there's also another way to this. Sometimes, an example is coming to mind, but I don't know if I want to take the time. But sometimes being not confrontational, but stable and strong in a stand can be a good reflection for someone. And that can also be the most compassionate thing one can do. Does that make sense to everyone? Pierre Valait used to caution people about compassion when we do the practice Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, the one that is compassionate and merciful. He said there's a danger that there's light and shadow of every wazifa mantra. In other traditions, it's called mantra, in our tradition, wazifa. He said one can become complacent or it can become an excuse for not taking action. So one wants to be mindful of the light and shadow that plays into the wazifas and these attributes. There's always that interplay. And he wanted us to be sure in our training that we didn't become complacent or lazy or ineffective if we needed to take a stand. So that's important to remember. Let's try to be mindful. And again, it's good if you have a good friend or a mentor, or teachers, or murshids, to talk to about it. You know, I'd like to get some feedback. You know, I'd like to get some feedback on this. You know, what is your point of view? I mean, it's someone that you feel you can trust and ask them. Do that before taking action. Now, again, we worked with Haleem, which is this idea of calm abiding, restful attention. It's a kind of mindfulness in and of itself. And now we get to the third point, which is really, we are beginning now this class for today. And Murshid says, just here for a minute, talks about identify with what you are not. Identify with what you are not. The third field of mental purification is to identify oneself with what one is not. By this, one purifies one's mind from impressions of one's false sense of identity. I remember, this is just a personal story and it may relate to you. I was at a conference in Switzerland and I had been invited by the people that had organized the conference to go to dinner with them. And I remember they said, tell us about yourself. And I said, and they already knew a little bit because I was presenting and I had been exhibiting work there and things. So I said, well, do you want to know what I do or do you want to know who I am? Because often, you know, we come with a litany of our accomplishments or where we've lived or what degrees we have, et cetera, et cetera. And in some certain contexts, very, very important. But it's not who we really are. I mean, we may have some mastery through accomplishment, but it's good to not be so attached to it. I can tell you, on the other side of retirement, I think it was very easy for me to let go of my roles because I knew that wasn't who I was. But I loved what I did, and I did it for many years, but I was ready to go on and be free. So, you know, think of that too, that we don't need to just identify with these impressions. That's, in a sense, could be what's called a false identity. And then Murshid goes on, this is a wonderful example, and you probably have had similar examples in your own life. He says, I'll give you an example. Once I was trying to help a person who was ill, who had rheumatism for 20 years. This woman was in bed. She could not move her joints. I came to her and told her, now you will do this, and I will come in 2 weeks' time. And when, after 2 weeks' time, I came, she'd already begun to move her joints. And I said, in 6 weeks, I will come back. And in 6 weeks, she got up out of bed and had greater hope for being cured. Nevertheless, her patience was not so great as it ought to have been. One day, she was lying in bed and thought, can I ever be cured? The moment she had that thought, she went back to the same condition because her soul had identified itself with a sick person. For her to see her own well-being was impossible. She could not imagine that she would ever be quite well. She could not believe her eyes, that her joints were moving. She just could not believe it. And then Murshid said, people can be well in their bodies, but not in their minds. They can be well in their bodies, but not in their minds. Very often, they hold to an illness which they could get rid of. And the same thing happens with misery. People who are conscious of misery attract miseries. Misfortune does not choose people. People choose misfortune. Boy, that's hard to hear, isn't it? It makes us really think about our lives and our thoughts and our conditions and how our thoughts are leading to the conditions in our lives and perpetuating them, when really it's all thoughts. It's illusory. I mean, in one sense it is. But let me ask you, I think the name of the movie is, it was done in Italian. I think it was Life is Beautiful. Does anyone remember that movie? And it was about the people in the concentration camp. And there was a man with his son in the German concentration camp. And the man decided that the little boy didn't need to feel the depths of despair of what was happening in the camp. Do you remember this movie? It was profound for me. And he made everything a game. And so that was the little boy's reality. Everything was hide and seek, or go get a little something for, you know, go steal something for a reward, or, you know, see if you could do this. And it was like, it was extraordinary to me, because it was all about how that man, the context in which the man put their experience. It's like that. Remember, Lord Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, you know, all life is suffering. But pain and suffering are different. I mean, do we habitually suffer over our pain is a question. Dalai Lama says that, you know, pain is inevitable in life, but suffering's optional. Suffering's optional. And I think, Habiba, you're a really good example of it. You did not let that sucker COVID get you down. You kept a positive, every time I check, I mean, I was checking in probably six times a day. How's it going? And you were always very positive, and you just very slowly kept moving through your days. It was a very good example. Thank you for that. Thank you. Excuse me. Therefore, the third aspect of mental purification is to be able to identify oneself with something else. Sufis have their own way of teaching it. Very often, one holds the idea of one's spiritual teacher or a spiritual ideal. And with that idea, one gains the knowledge and inspiration and power of the spiritual teacher or the spiritual ideal. It is just like a heritage. Have you had the experience where you feel like you've come into attunement with a particular aspect or array of the divine? It could be the divine mother, the divine father, a bodhisattva, Hazrat and Nikon, Murshid Samuel Lewis. But when we tune into that being, it also maybe helps shift our view. Have you had that experience yourself? I hope so. You know, they say, I hear people say, what would Jesus do under these circumstances? Or what would Buddha do under these circumstances? I often think of my own teacher as Eminence Comtal Rinpoche, or His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's been, my God, he's doing live posts all the time on Facebook. Are you catching those people? It's amazing. He has the huge television screen set up, and he has many, many people from around the world on one, and then he's kind of one larger screen is like speaker view, and sometimes he's doing panel conversations or questions and answers. It's like 85 years old and really going for it, you know, getting the message out there. How amazing, so inspiring. So thinking of one's teacher, we know that that's a path here, Fana Fashek, you know, a self-annihilation in the image of one's teacher, or in the image of God, or in the image of a particular saint or prophet. So that attunement, shifting the view. In design school, we would call it, what did we call that methodology? Maybe Jem is there and can remind me. I think it was like, it was either called the get out of town or being the foreigner. So it's like you come about a design problem in a way that, you know, I mean, my thing was I would always think of a great designer and how they would approach that problem and how they would solve it. So I could get out of my own little mind. It's like, well, what would their thinking process be? You know, their theoretical and their, you know, their process. So it's helpful to do these little things, if you can, with one's small mind to get to that bigger field of mind, capital M. So Murshid goes on to say, a person who cannot concentrate so much as to forget oneself and go deep into the subject on which one concentrates will not succeed in mastering concentration. And in other aspects of the teachings, Murshid talks about the fact that concentration is so essential to be able to penetrate through concepts, problems, conflicts. You know, what's the penetrating wisdom that takes us to the core issue that can open things up? So concentration is essential. And also, Murshid Hidayat and Icon would often say to us, those of you remember, concentration is one thing, but deconcentration is another. That's when we can fall into this very open, expansive field beyond the notion of self. So concentrating, it's like exercise. You hold something, hope something, and when you release it, there's a great release. We can do this with our training, our inward training. So here I'd like to maybe just, should we go on to a practice and then we can have some discussion? Would that be good? A practice that kind of highlights this teaching. Thank you. I'm getting a few thumbs up. So, and it's not something that we haven't worked with in the past. And most of you know this name, Alim. Ya'alim, it is this this intuitive knowledge that we can tune to. Maybe we don't always have, but we can tune into that. We can find that. They often say Alim means all-knowing. But here's a beautiful quote by Neil Douglas Klotz in his book, The Sufi Book of Life. And he says, the greatest learning and knowing is knowledge of self. As the companion of Muhammad, Imam Ali said, whoever knows oneself knows the one. Whoever knows oneself knows the one. So this gets back to even the camp teaching where we were talking about the soul and how that soul is part of the light of God, and it then comes to earth, and we're still connected to that source. We forget it. We think we're out here, but we can always travel that line back to the source. So whoever knows oneself knows the one, capital O, knows the one. And he goes on to say, this is Neil Douglas Klotz again, Aline refers to the ability to know and to understand all the worlds of form, all the worlds of form. The classical Sufis refer to two essentials of the spiritual path as ilm, I-L-M, divine intelligence. And this is related to Aline, ilm, Aline. The other essential element is ishq, I-S-C-K or I-S, excuse me, I-S-H-K or I-S-H-Q, sometimes it is spelled. And that's divine passion. So divine intelligence with divine passion. And he says, head and heart balance each other in the way of transformation. Head and heart balance each other in the way of transformation. The other practice we're going to go back to, which we did before, was that wasi. Wasi. And then there's apostrophe at the end over the I, so it's wasi. It's kind of a guttural stop. Wasi, like that. And again, wasi is this all-embracing, all-sufficient, boundless quality. It's mercy and generosity is balanced, but it's also the wazifa, the practice, the sacred name that can help us release old boundaries. And it is an antidote to rigid, habitual boundaries. So again, when we feel we're stuck or we're in a box, or we say maybe somebody else has put us in a box, well, wasi might be really good to dust off and use. So we're going to use these two in tandem. We're going to begin with Aline, calling upon divine wisdom, divine understanding, divine insight, intuitive knowledge coming through. And then we're going to expand that, starting at the heart and expanding in ever-widening circles, 360 degrees, and just all-embracing. Okay, let me get my prayer beads off here and we'll begin. We'll do the first 11 kind of on the tone to kind of open the vibration up. And then we'll do, the pattern. We say Ya Aline, Ya Wasia, and then after we go through the recitation, first 11 we'll do on the tone. I'll keep us on track. And then the remaining 30 to get to 34, we'll just do spoken. And then when we go to the breath, we'll breathe in Aline and out Wasia. In Aline, out Wasia. Okay? And then we just go silently on the breath, in and out, feeling that vibration that we've set up internally, circulating through all of the cells of the body, into the deep soul, the deep consciousness, the heart. So we'll again begin with the tone. Yali. Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya. Now, spoken. Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya, Yali, Yahwasya. You may bow your head on Yali, bringing divine knowledge inward, and Yahwasya. It goes up slightly with the consciousness, expanding, all-embracing. So drawing down, Yam, and then Yahwasya, Yali, 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 Yahwasya. Now, on the whisper, we breathe in Aleem and out Wasya. And now just silently feeling on the breath, the circulation of these qualities, these divine qualities. Divine knowledge and the one that expands to spread this knowledge to all things. Ya'alim, Ya'awasim. There are really only a few more sentences of this teaching, but kind of make mental notes of any questions you may have had or experiences that you wish to share, and then we can open up the to some conversation, some soft bit. So the last thing Murshid suggests as far as unlearning is to relax the mind. Relax the mind. And Murshid says, the fifth way is to be able to, the fifth way is to be able to repose one's mind. In other words, to relax the mind. Simple as it seems, very few know the resting of the mind and how wonderful it is in itself. And what power and what inspiration comes as a reaction from it. And what peace does one experience by it. And how it helps the body and mind. The spirit is renewed once the mind has had its rest. The spirit is renewed once the mind has its rest. Now, Murshid's going to give us some clues because you may be saying, well, how do you do that? Am I right? Is anyone asking that? Okay. I only see a few of you. Are you smiling? Are you with me? Okay. The first step towards resting the mind is the relaxation of the body. The first step towards resting of the mind is the relaxation of the body. So some of you maybe have taken mindfulness meditation classes, and one of the practices is to scan the body. And without doing anything, just observe where there may be tension. And then the next step is to ask that tension to, don't command, no sudden moves, but to suggest that the body comes in, those areas come into relaxation, release the tension. So the first step towards resting of the mind is the relaxation of the body. And some of you may know this, you just sometimes feel you have to go take a rest and put the body horizontally and take a few breaths and close the eyes. Then the teaching goes on to say, if one is able to relax one's muscular and nervous system at will, then the mind is automatically refreshed. This is a very important, I would suggest when we send out the study guide, go back to this and read, especially this last piece. Someone's not muted. I don't know, Shamsuddin or Gemma, if you can find them and maybe mute them. I'm hearing something in the background. Thank you. So if one is able to relax one's muscular and nervous system at will, then the mind is automatically refreshed. Besides that, one must be able to cast away anxiety, worries, doubts, and fears by the power of the will. Now, there's that quote, and I know Shamsuddin or Mudita, you know that. It's something Murshid Waliali repeats, and it's been circulating on the Jamiat costs lately, the prayer, you help me make it correct, in unison with the will of God, we will to will. Can someone help me there?
In unison with the will of God,
we will to have peace.
In unison with the will of God, Habiba?
We will to have peace.
In unison with the will of God, we will to have peace.
And one could use that phrase here also, in unison with the will of God, we will to have strength. We will to have courage. We will to have certainty. We will to have clarity. We will to have a loving heart. You can use that beautiful phrase, in unison with the will of God, we will to have a calm, be at calm and at ease. Use these phrases. The fact is that's the power of prayer. That's the power of prayer. Those prayers have been said in so many mouths, in so many hearts. The vibrations are in the atmosphere. We unite with them. We can call upon them to aid us. So in unison with the will of God, we will to have peace. We will to have understanding. We will to have tolerance. We will to have sufficient means for everyone. All of these things can be prayers for oneself and for all beings. Scott and I were texting a little earlier about how potent this time is. I think you're aware of it. I mean, you've been mentioning it's the solstice. And Murshida Vira used to say, put your sky hook out and catch it. It's like the idea that this relationship is happening right now between our planet and the sun. And, you know, can we grasp onto that and carry it around to the next cycle, that it can propel our dreams, our ambitions, our prayers, our thoughts. We can use the energy of that turning. You know, Murshida Vira would always have us, for ladies, she always had us, and I know, Salima, you're there, maybe some others that participated in this monthly, sort of we united wherever we were, but she would have us set an intention. For ladies, it was always on the new moon. And she would get us, so we were very aware of that. So we'd set our prayers, we'd set our intentions on the new moon. And then, as the light filleth the crescent moon, we would concentrate on that, to bring it to fruition. And with men, it was slightly different. She would have them do it on the full moon so that that would go deeply into their being as the light receded. And it brought them into a more inner process, the women to a more external process. Very interesting. She understood the elements very well. And it's a very potent time right now. Tune in, use it. Use it, make those prayers. So Murshid says, if one is able to relax one's muscular and nervous system at will, then the mind is automatically refreshed. Besides that, one must be able to cast away anxiety, worries, doubts, and fears by the power of will. Putting oneself in a restful state, this will be accomplished by the help of proper breathing. So, long elongated breaths give you a sense of spaciousness, a sense of more time. There's the whole science of breath. You can study in Murshid Sam's library. He does a whole, many, many commentaries on the culture of breath, but mostly feeling. The in-breath and the out-breath, focusing on this moment, nothing else can arise. I mean, our anxieties come from projecting ourselves into the future. In my worst moments, in my most sorrowful, sad moments, I remind myself, if I'm in this moment, I'm not suffering. I'm not clinging to what has gone before, and I'm not grasping to what's coming. It helps us through cycles of grief, loss, and so forth, change. We're certainly in those times now. So being mindful, and it's a good time to be mindful of the breath. So proper breathing. Sending the breath to those areas that may have tension, because those can also be obscurations or obstacles. They're holding some impression there. Can we release them? The last line of this teaching is, great magnetism is produced by having stilled and purified the mind. Great magnetism, or we could say great capacity, or great influence, could replace that word magnetism, is produced by having stilled and purified the mind. You know, people often joke at that saying, don't do something, sit there. Kind of Buddhist circles, they say. Don't do something, just sit there. And sometimes just by stilling the mind. It's like that metaphor that, I don't know, we maybe, I think it's in the Qigong practice we've talked about it, where, you know, you have the jar and you shake it up and it becomes muddy, and then if you let it just sit, all the sediment goes to the bottom and then the water is clear. It's like that too. Sometimes we have to let things settle, let them go, and things become clearer. So there's a, I just want to read one more thing, and then we'll have like 15 minutes for those that wish to stay. This is from a reading. It's a teaching by Hazaranaik Khan, and there's a commentary by Murshid Samuel Lewis. And it's so relevant, I think, to this body of teachings by Anaik Khan. And the reading is, we are the picture of the reflection of our imagination. We are the picture of the reflection of our imagination. We are as large or as small as we think ourselves. Not what other people are thinking of us. They will have their thoughts. It's okay, let them. But we are as large or as small as we think ourselves. And then this is Murshid Samuel Lewis's commentary. He says, so long as our thought is centered around our concept of a limited self, we are limited by the power of thought. When we rise to the fullness of life in the cosmic unity, finding that God alone is and is the true self, we are no longer limited. And what was that limited us? It was nothing but our own thought, just as thought can attain all knowledge of matter, so can spirit attain all knowledge of thought. And so can God attainment give all knowledge to the spirit. Just as thought can attain all knowledge of matter, penetrating thought, so can spirit gain all knowledge of thought, observing the thoughts. What are we holding in our thought forms that will become form? We'll bring it into reality, we'll give birth to it. So just as thought can attain all knowledge of matter, penetrating, so can spirit gain all knowledge of thought, uplifting us, raises above the denseness of the earth, looking at it from an objective point of view. And so can God attainment give all knowledge to spirit, keeping that connection to the sun. The sun. We are all sons and daughters of God, and we return on those rays to that source.